This is The Conversation, episode number 102 with Kelsey Lee Offield. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com. And if you have not been there yet, I would say hold off maybe until about maybe 45 minutes into this episode. I want you to be surprised about who the Gusford in Gusford Gallery is, which Kelsey runs. So before we get to more on this coming episode, I wanted to remind you that I, myself, and this podcast, ourselves, are not the media. As you may have heard me say if you've listened to recent episodes, I am not the media. And why do I say that? Why aren't you the media, first of all, Michael? Why are you not the media? And when are you going to be the media? I will never be the media. I don't imagine. This is too small an operation, and the conversations I have are conversations and hopefully, in the best of cases, performances of sorts. They're not coverage. They're not reporting. So those are the things that I would point out or distinguish this and me from being the media. And why am I so worried about being the media? Because I'm an artist, and this is a artistic project. It's not a news project. Despite the I word, the interview word, which I always try to avoid, as you know, and want to stay away from. And I say all this because very recently, Angles Gallery in Los Angeles, in Culver City specifically, formerly of Santa Monica, closed after 30 years. Did you know this? If you're out of LA, you probably didn't notice and you probably don't necessarily care, but this is a long life, a very long life for a gallery in any city. And Tom Solomon Gallery closed in the last year as well. And what they both have in common is that I don't think there was any coverage. Los Angeles Times, nor any other institution of media, made note of these stories. And so I guess the theme is that you're either such a big gallery that you live on indefinitely, you know, the big galleries of the world, or you die and you fade away into nothingness and nobody remembers that you were even there to an extent. But all that to say, that I reached out to one of the people involved with Angles for a number of years and asked if he would like to have a conversation about it. And he was open to it initially. He thought about it and then he declined. So I just want to let you know that I wanted to give you and them or him an opportunity to talk about that story, which I think would have been interesting. And it's a shame we don't get to hear it, but that's the story. Now on to this episode with a young dealer, Kelsey Lee Offield. Gusford Gallery is just over 2 years old now, and they're going to be moving into a new space soon, perhaps summer, very likely summer it looks like. And I sat down in a very cool red leather banquette in the sports bar of Kelsey's home in the Hollywood Hills. I just thought I'd give you a little visual there. She had to put aside some very cool ceramic drink holders, if that's right, Kelsey, from Benihana. They're actually quite cool. You'd be surprised. I kind of am interested in having one or two of those myself after having seen them. And I think we had a great conversation, and I wanted to emphasize the fact that this, you may recognize that this is kind of an old school style, which is a one-on-one conversation in person, which I haven't done in a while. All the ones I do over the phone are one-on-one, but in person, it's been quite a while because I've adopted this co-hosting thing. I thought it was more appropriate in this case to go the one-on-one route. I think it came out really well. I hope you enjoy it as well. What else do you need to know? We do talk about her background, which is quite interesting, and her biography goes on for a good portion of the conversation before we get into some more intense stuff about what it's like to be a dealer, what it's like to be a woman dealer, what her background is and what that means, and so on. So that will come if you are curious earlier on, and I would stay tuned for it. I would also hold off on going to theconversationpod.com or elsewhere to find out who Gusford, the namesake of the gallery, is. I would say find out in the conversation and then go look at the website and feast your eyes. All right. I will talk to you on the back end. Thank you very much for being here, and I will talk to you later. Potentially mention the fact that we're in your sports bar.
We are in my sports bar movie theater room. There's a drop-down screen that covers that Amir Fala painting. And this is where I hoard all of my sports memorabilia.
Right, right.
So,
and being a dealer who's also a jock slash sports aficionado has got to be a very rare combination.
Yes, I have one artist who called me a unicorn because he said he'd never met someone in the arts who was a woman who loved sports as much as I do or as he does or what have you.
Right.
So, yeah, it's clearly rare to be a sports fan, and in the art world, it's obviously more rare to be a woman and be an avid sports fan.
Well, I was going to ask you, have you found that if the subject of sports comes up in, you know, art context, that you get a lot of blank looks?
Or do
you
just not? No. I mean, I get a lot of blank stares. The girl, my director, knows absolutely nothing about sports. And then handful of my artists do, and they obviously, we love to talk about it because it's not something that you run into all the time. And she just blanks out. She has no idea what we're talking about. I was talking about Floyd Mayweather the other day. She had no idea who he was. I'm like, do you look at anything? I'm like, you don't even have to like sports.
Right.
I don't particularly like boxing, but I know who he is.
Right.
She had no idea who he was, so I was like...
Is your breadth of sports interest wide, would you say? Or is it...
Yes.
Okay.
I would say yes.
Where are you on the spectrum of tennis?
I love tennis.
Okay.
I play it avidly.
All right, well,
let's
let's talk about the Australian Open 2015.
Yes,
what are your thoughts?
Roger Federer is out, and I loved it when he almost lost in the second round, and his response was... Oh, I just didn't want to have to explain why I lost in the second round. And then he proceeded to lose. And I was like, well, so now you just have to explain why you lost in the third round. And he was like, oh, I'm just having a bad day.
What are you feeling about Roger these days?
Oh,
Were you or have you ever been a big fan of his?
Yeah, why not? I think he's great. I think he's a well-balanced, overall good player. If I had, you know, when it was Rafa and Roger, I was always more of a Roger fan. He's even keeled, and I used to hate Rafa's capri pants and sleeveless shirt outfit. So I'm so happy that he changed that a few years ago, and he's grown on me since changing his attire, but I hated that look. So you had to pick a
so you
size.
Okay, so now we're already coming to an aesthetic sports cross point, which is that you hold athletes' appearances and stylistic choices in very high regard.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I grew up playing in an old school tennis club where you still to this day you have to wear all white. So
what's the club?
It's a tiny little social club in Harbor Springs, Michigan, where I grew up spending my summers. And you have to wear all white. So I remember playing tennis the first time out in California and showing up to the court in all white. And my friends were like, what do you think you're at Wimbledon? And that was just what I knew. I knew that you wore all white. We're not allowed to, I mean, you're technically allowed to have like 10% color flair at
right.
a club. It's very strict. So for me, tennis is that. It's very old school. It's strict. So that aesthetic and that etiquette and that comes into it. And, you know, but baseball is hands down my favorite of all the sports. And if I've said this a million times, if I owned a baseball team, they would all have to wear their pants fitted and up to the knee and wear the socks And, you know, if Steinbrenner can force the Yankees to be clean shaven, I figured I could always force my players to rock the socks, you know, that proper old school uniform. None of this baggy pants below the cleats, hats on sideways, thug look that we've got going now. That doesn't work for me. I like that.
I grew up a big baseball fan, but I've been oblivious to it as an adult. And yet I did happen to hear a conversation about, you know, the variation of trends with the socks and, you know, like the stirrups have been basically, you know, tossed to the side and so on and so forth. So it's funny to hear you talk about that. But yeah, I mean, with Nadal, I've always been more of a Nadal than a Federer guy. I mean, I think like a lot of people, I got just a little tired of sort of Federer's dominance. But I will give you, in retrospect especially, the capri pants and tank top combination.
Tank top, and he had his left arm is like three times bigger than his right arm. And that was the only thing I could look at. I'm like, you're so unbalanced. I'm like, you've got this like tiny little T-Rex arm and this huge arm. And I'm like, cover those things up if it's going to be so imbalanced. I mean, there was a whole slew of things in the early Rafa years that led me to like Roger Federer. Or Roger Better. you know, I mean, I just have respect for him and his dominance.
Okay, well, I guess we've exhausted the Australian Open part of our conversation for now. So, okay, well, this is interesting. A whole bunch of different pieces are swirling around in that. You are from Laguna Beach, it's correct to say?
I grew up on Catalina Island.
Okay.
Until I was 8 years old. And then from 8 to 18, I was in Laguna Beach. So certainly there's 10-year...
Right. And when were you doing the Michigan summers all growing up?
All of them. All 31 years on this planet I've been spent. My father grew up in Chicago. So his parents lived in Chicago, and they spent their summers in Harbor Springs. My father spent his summers there. His parents spent their summers there. I mean, like, it for years and years and years. So as my entire life, I've been spending my summers there. My father retired about 2 years ago, and he decided to retire up there full time. So he left California to go there. So even as an adult, when I've traveled a lot, I consider Harbor Springs even more of a home, even though I've never lived there full time. More so than Laguna, because I go there every single year, even to this day, where I only go down to Laguna to see my family occasionally, but I don't have a strong connection to my childhood life there as I do to my childhood life in Harbor Springs.
Mm-hmm. And what is the story with Harbor Springs? I mean, what kind of community is it?
Oh, my goodness. Americana. Through and through and through. They're summer cottages, and people from, you know, a lot of people from downstate Michigan and Chicago area that spend their summers there. A lot of Southerners from Oklahoma. So I'm a huge Oklahoma fan because my best friends is from Oklahoma and from Georgia. But so from all over, and they're just kind of like old families that have been doing this for years and years and years. And I think one of the things that it really taught me growing up is those friends I've known my entire life. But when we were little, we didn't communicate because, you know, it's like the 80s and the 90s. We didn't have like cell phones or email. So we would see each other every summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like nothing, you know, we'd catch up on what happened in the year, but we were friends all the time. And as you grow up and you become an adult, you know, we all know it takes effort to maintain friendships. But we learned those skills from the time we were first met at 2 or 3. And so our friendships can last long periods without communication. And so they're enduring, and I value them highly.
Right. Is it some men as well, or?
Oh yeah, I mean, I have two brothers, so
right,
and I have a twin brother, so I'm as close to all of them. But yeah, it's a core group of like 100 people that we're all just really, really tight friends. And, you know, it makes the world very, very small to have that when they're from all over. Because then anywhere you go, you're bound to know someone that knows someone.
Right. So. Was Harbor Springs?
Harbor Springs.
Is it, would you say, call it maybe a WASPy community?
Yes.
I mean, you did mention the country club, so I figured.
Yes. Yeah. It's, you know, but it's small town America, and it's a summer destination. It has a very small winter local population, very small. And, you know, as I said, my father now lives there full time. So I obviously know the local population as well as they call the summer people fudgies. The people that come in for, cause there's a lot of fudge up there. It's very close to Mackinac Island and Mackinac Island fudge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know the whole community. My grandmother started an art nonprofit up there, however many years ago, a long time ago, that I sat on the board of for a number of years called Crooked Tree Art Center that, is just dedicated to keeping art prevalent in the local community, in the winter community, in the full-time community, because it's a small town, northern Michigan, you know, that's like something that can easily get lost from public funding. So,
right.
Yeah.
So does the art background go from there? Is that kind of where the roots are?
That's one vein of the roots. My grandparents on my father's side were avid art collectors, and their home was one half art studio. My grandfather was an incredibly accomplished needle pointer. My grandmother had a pottery studio, and I mean, they only made it for themselves, but that was something they like definitely valued in their life and in their lifestyle. And they were patrons in the way that they found an artist, and they really supported that artist through their entire career and, you know, and made sure that they could maintain not just like collecting, but really support the artist. And then on my mother's side, my grandmother, you know, studied art in college. I mean, she's 85 years old this year. I mean, that's awesome. That's what she did in college back in, I can't even do that math, a long time ago. I have some of her drawings hanging in my house. I love it.
So your dad's parents were patrons, have been patrons.
Very much so. What,
are there some artists that come to mind that they supported?
They were big supporters of Maynard Dixon, who is does, you know, American West paintings, and great supporters of Todd Werner, who does these whimsical ceramic animals, who he has a studio up in Michigan as well, which is how they first came across him. But, you know, they spent a lot of time in Arizona and in the desert, so they have a lot of that, like, American West art. And so, I mean, but those are two that were really great that they were, you know, I know, very significant.
Is this the side of the family then that is connected to the Wrigley?
Yeah.
So you mentioned, and we'll just give people a little lead in that you, since you mentioned Catalina, I actually spent a vacation there when I was very young. So I remember hearing Wrigley gum connected to this island of Catalina. So why don't you tell me about where that runs in the family?
So my great-grandfather was William Wrigley Jr., started the company. So that's the Chicago roots and the Midwest roots, and Arizona and Catalina are all, I guess, based from the Wrigley family. So
the Wrigley Gum Company was in Chicago?
Yeah. That's okay. Where it was founded, and that's where it was based until it was sold a few years ago. William Wrigley Jr. bought Catalina Island and owned it and is now mostly in a conservancy, but part of it is run by the Catalina Island Company, Santa Catalina Island Company, which is what my father ran for his entire working career. And then 99% of the island's in a nature conservancy, which my father's still on the board of and connected with. So,
what was the Santa Catalina Company involved
The
with?
Island company. Yeah. It runs like the tourisms and the hotels, and you know, like if you've been over there, like those brown tour buses that go around, or you know, the glass bottom boat. I mean, it has its finger in a lot of little honeypots over there. So
right.
The golf course and several of the hotels and several of the restaurants and a slew of
things. Just out of curiosity, because I haven't been there since I was a kid, so it's all pretty hazy, but I know that you come into, is Avalon's the town, and that's also where you land your boat docks. Is the rest of the island fairly barren, or is it fairly covered?
So Avalon is the primary town, and that's not private. And then the rest of the island is privately held in this conservancy now. And so it's not developed. I mean, there are homes out there. There's like a horse ranch, and there's the airport, and there's like various bits, if you were to go back there, that are all part on conservancy land. And but there's something like 95 species of plants that only exist on Catalina Island and the Catalina Island fox. So the conservancy is dedicated to preserving these species of plants and then the fox that don't exist anywhere else in the world. So, yeah, it's not developed. It's very natural. And then where I'm guessing you spent your vacation, in the coves all along the coast, are little camps that are mainly only inhabited in the summer. And there's like a Boy Scout camp, and there's a Christian camp, and there's the Catalina Island Marine Institute, where my father went to high school and then was a teacher there for years. And, you know, it's all along. There's tons of little camps that most Californians grow up spending at least one summer somewhere in one of those camps.
Right. And I mean, my understanding of the town generally is that it's very tourist dominated, right?
Absolutely.
Like a New England summer. Tourist trap.
Like Harbor Springs. It's got a heavy, I mean, it has an entire summer population. So my mother grew up spending every summer in Catalina. Her parents are her father was a native Californian, and she grew up in Pasadena. My grandfather was the president of the Rose Parade. And so she grew up spending all of her summers in Harbor Springs, in Catalina, which is how she met my father. So as we were little kids, we grew up on the island as locals in the winter, and then spent our summers. We escaped the tourism of Catalina in the summer and went and spent our summers in Harbor Springs.
Right. That's ironic. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you were so young that maybe you weren't that aware of like how dead it was during the rest of the year.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, you're a little kid, and you know, like when I was 5 or 6, when I was in kindergarten, it was like you had to walk home. I mean, Avalon itself, it's like 1 square mile. It's tiny. So we had to walk home from school. I mean, can you imagine nowadays saying your 5-year-old has to walk home from school? Like, and we lived on the opposite side of town. Like, would never happen.
Yeah.
But it was great. And we were like little wild kids. We would play hide and go seek in the hillside. And then we would stop at my dad's office and get hot chocolate from his secretary. And then, I mean, it would take us like 3 hours. I'm sure, like, if we'd been anywhere else, our parents would have thought we'd gotten kidnapped. But
right.
We were on Catalina Island. Like, we were just wild island little
paradise.
Island. Yeah. Well, island babies.
Right.
We learned how to swim.
So they were grooming you to be independent movers and shakers.
Absolutely. Yes.
then do you think it was inevitable that you would get into art? I mean, you had an art history focus, right?
Yeah, I think, I was torn. Sports are very high, and I thought I wanted to be a team doctor for the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim. But
wait a second. Let's go back a second.
This is a very specific career.
Well, it is. No, I was going to say, I thought you were going professional sports. So I guess I want to know how old did you get to be before you sort of let go of the grip of being a professional athlete?
That's a good question. I think I probably in the back of my mind probably never really let that one go. In sure. High school at some point I'd switched and then was like, if I'm a team doctor, this would be great, you know. And then I was like, oh my god, I hate biology, I can't do this for the rest of my life. And so my senior year in high school I was in AP biology and I hated it, and I was in AP art and I loved it. And so but I had already applied off to colleges and I had declared a pre-med course. So I got to college and quickly dropped all those classes, was like, ugh, I don't want to do this, and started taking art history classes and really loved it. Dropped out of school after 3 semesters, went to Europe, really, really loved it, came back, and my family was like, you can do whatever you want as long as you go back to school. So
what was the story behind dropping out?
It's not a great story. I guess I was this California blonde beach girl. I'd gone to Boston University. I was so excited. You know, 1 week there, I'm sitting in French class at like 7 o'clock in the morning and my phone is like blowing up, and I finally come out of the class and my dad's like, call me immediately. Tell me you didn't get on an airplane. And so I'm standing in the coffee shop getting ready to call my dad, and 9/11 happened. And I was like, it was too much for me to handle. I'd come out of Laguna Beach into Boston and all of a sudden the whole world changed. And, you know, I wasn't focused on what I wanted to do. And being in school wasn't just the right environment for me at the time. So I went to Europe and bought a one-way ticket, traveled around and really settled on what made me happy, but I needed to take that time to figure it out because it was just all moving too fast. It was 3 semesters, like I said, before I'd gotten there, I'd declared pre-med and I knew I didn't want to do that, but I hadn't figured out what I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to do something with art, but I hadn't figured out what that something was.
Right.
So I just took some time and
it seems to me that you're right around the age that you could still have that freedom, and like the generation maybe just beyond, you know, or the ages just younger than yours is kind of where is the beginning of the streamlining of careers. And, you know, and like you there's no such thing as undeclared. You can't not know what you're going to do if you're going to college. Yeah. Right.
I mean, and I think that I think my parents were very understanding. And I think that the fact that I grew up in a family that was very supportive of art and artists gave me that luxury to take that time. But, I mean, I certainly felt the pressure of, like, having to know what I wanted to do. And I had always been. I was an athlete. I was a varsity athlete. I was a very good student. And then I got to school. And I had always – my focus was, you know, in high school it was – to go to college. And then once I got to college, I was like, oh, what's my focus? And once I found that focus, you know, it's been a very strong trajectory to get me to where I am today. I went back to school. I went to the University of Puget Sound. I studied art history. I went to Cornish College of the Arts. I studied painting, sculpture, and photography. I went to Sotheby's in London and studied contemporary art. I moved to LA, opened an art gallery. You know, I mean, it was a very, like, once I figured that plan out, you know, I just took the steps I needed to take to get to where I am.
And we're done. Thank you very much. Just kidding. What about the studying art? Was that a logical thing, or was that kind of a? I mean, when you were studying art history, were you thinking I'm going to go into the sort of art history type of field, whether it's gallery or something, or did you not know at that point?
I think when I was studying art history, I went to a liberal arts college that made us take studio classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I loved that side of it, though I don't know what it was about me or my mind. I just never really thought I want to be an artist. That wasn't something at that time that I thought I wanted to do. And I'd been working in galleries as my summer job and as my after school job. And I have a very vivid memory. Someone had walked in and they were buying this oil painting, and it was this painting of red flowers, and there was this big dollop of red paint on the painting. And I'm like wrapping it up and I'm chatting with this lady that's buying it. She goes, "How long do you think it took that dollop of paint to dry?" And I'm like, I have no idea. I didn't know if it was minutes, seconds, months, years. I couldn't even fathom a guess. And so it was just like one of those, you know, light bulb moments. I was young. I really wanted to know everything I could know. I was eager to learn. So I went to art school to have a better understanding of how art is made to make me a better gallerist. Then I happened to really, once I was involved in the artist's life, I happened to love it. I got good feedback. I happened to be kind of good at it. And I just kept doing it for quite a while, but I was never as committed to that dream as I was to opening the gallery. So even as I worked as an artist, I always knew I was going to open my gallery and was just using that time and experience to become a better gallerist.
Right.
I hope.
Because you would be empathetic to what the artists are doing.
Absolutely. And I've, you know, been on that side of that relationship of working with gallerists.
What was the school that you mentioned? Was that in England?
The art school I went to?
Yeah.
In Seattle, Washington, Cornish College of the Arts.
What's Cornish?
The name of the school? Ooh. Oh, Nellie Cornish. She's the founder.
Oh, okay. So it's a small school, presumably?
Yeah. And it's just an art school. So they only give out BFAs, I guess.
Right.
And
so this was an undergraduate art school, basically.
Yeah, so okay. I did two undergraduates. So I have my BA in art history, and then I have my BFA in painting, sculpture, and photography.
Okay.
And I could do three majors because I already had all my academic hoopla out of the way when I got to Cornish. And
right.
So I had time on my hands.
Right. So then as you were, you know, doing the BFA and making art, you were at some point figuring I'm going to need another art career type of degree.
Well, no, I always wanted to get my master's. And when I was doing my undergraduate, I had studied abroad in London, which is how I first came across the master's program at Sotheby's in London. And I knew I wanted to do that program. I wasn't in any rush, you know. I went to school with plenty of girls who came and got their master's straight out of their undergraduate, and as far as I know, very few of them are in the art world at all anymore. You know, you just don't know. You're not quite ready to be that committed to something. Plenty of people are, but it just wasn't something I was totally needed at that moment. And I was really eager to do the art school thing. I'd just come out of a very academic institution, and the art school sounded like kind of almost a nice break while still being productive and doing something.
Mm-hmm.
But not, you know, just going straight into another academic program.
Why did you say girls?
Because I was thinking of two in particular that came straight out, and one is now studying pre-med, and the other one does catering in the Hamptons.
So what about the boys?
There were only two boys in our entire program. One owns a gallery in Guadalajara and is doing very well, and the other one has a great job. I think he works for Christie's or Sotheby's.
So you're talking about people in your Sotheby's class?
Yeah, in my master's program.
Got it.
So there were only two. There were 50 of us and only two boys. So
right.
There was a
Okay.
Sorry.
Understood. So, yeah. Yes. I wasn't clear if we were talking about the art school or the post.
No. So yeah, okay. In my master's program.
Well, you know, it's not a coincidence that you use that word, that you say girls, because I mean, at least it's a question anyway. It seems to me, just strictly objectively, that the art, let's see, well, I'm trying to figure out the growth and the people getting educated and being groomed for the art world in a art historical slash business context seem to be dominated by women. Does that seem about right?
Yes and no. I would say that, as we were discussing previously, that there was the contemporary program and then there's the art business program. And there were, I would say that the business program was about 50% men. So men were just more drawn to that. My program just happened to only have two men in it. And I don't know if there's something about the contemporary art degree. But, I mean, I understand what you're saying. But art world through and through has always been a male-dominated career. And men tend to find more success in it, even if women are being groomed and having that higher education.
Right.
There's like roles that the women have, and then there's the men.
Yeah. See, I think we've landed on something really interesting. And I think the part of the subtext of my bringing up the, you know, it seems like there are so many, you know, women out there like in these programs and then becoming interns and, you know, and rising up into big galleries. The subtext of that is that there is this, you know, feminist recognition of the imbalance, you know, as there is in, you know, all aspects of the professional world, but certainly in the art world, mm-hmm. with galleries, you know, with mm-hmm. artists dominated by men. And if you look at the high-end galleries, you could, I suppose you could come up with a pretty good argument that it's dominated by men in terms of dealers, in terms mm-hmm. of directors, and so on. But I just from a personal experience level, I keep having this perception. I mean, in LA, it just seems like there are tons of dealers who are women, and the up and coming dealers all seem to be women. So there's just this disconnect between, you know, the reality maybe that there's this, you know, men continuing to, you know, keep push the women out kind of dynamic versus the women rising up.
I mean, I think that from our perspective being here in LA and from my perspective as owning a gallery in Hollywood, that we're all women over there. We've got Sean Regan and Gavlak and Hannah Hoffman and various Small Fires, and LAX Art is run by Lori Furstenberg, and Los Angeles Nomadic Division is run by all women over there with Shamim and, you know, Erica Redling and Diane Ronstein. We've got tons of women over there, so it certainly feels like that. But then look over at Culver City, it's a lot of men, male run galleries over in Culver City.
Okay, I suppose. I haven't done the breakdown, so I'm gonna have to get back to you on that, but I'll take your word for it.
There's women over there, but
well, I think maybe a more important or more sort of incisive question, hopefully, is to what extent do you feel any sexism or experience it?
I think that there's the inherent sexism. I think that it's less here in LA. And I think we've got a lot of really great, strong women running a great program of galleries here in LA. Getting my master's and living over in Europe for 4 years before coming out here, I would say that men still run a lot of the show over in Europe. That's a much more male-dominated art world, and there's certainly powerful women over there, but you see that old school and you'll experience that sexism, you know? I mean, but for me, of course, that's been an experience, and it doesn't help that I'm young and, you know, not particularly hideous looking. So you just experience these ageists and sexist things as you're growing up. But, and I guess I was cognizant of it when I was working hard to get my education so that I wasn't just coming in, you know. And I think going back to why a lot of women do it, because we don't need it, but I certainly felt like I would have more value in the art world if I had the education to back it up. I don't know, maybe men don't feel like they need to have the education. I'm not a man. I don't know. But I would say that that was a driving force of getting my education and my ducks in a row before opening a gallery. I was always cognizant of the fact that if I just rolled in and opened a gallery and was like, oh, hey, I'm just doing this because I want to and happen to be a Wrigley and I can afford to do this, I wouldn't get taken very seriously. But if I come in and do that and I also have the education,
right,
then, you know, I'm not going to just be discredited for being, you know, doing this.
What about, how about that perception, though, that you alluded to, you know, the Wrigley element? I mean, because I was going to ask you what ducks you had to get in a row, and I think you essentially outline what those are, but even having gotten the degree, you know, and spent a lot of time in Europe, you know, learning the international sort of circuit in a sense, is that something that you're, how cognizant are you of that?
Very. And I have spent a whole long slew of my life not talking about my family or that side of my upbringing or my life. I mean, I have lifelong friends that I remember the first time it like even came out, it was in an article when I'd opened the gallery, and it wasn't something I talked about. It was something that the people writing the article had Googled and used. And so like I called up a handful of friends and was like, oh, by the way, I know we've, you know, been friends for a long time and we've never talked about this. Just, you might read this. I don't want you to think that I've been lying to you because I have, you know, but it's just not something that is super important. And it wasn't even something that was necessarily a factor. I think my parents did a good job of keeping me in small communities. And then I've done a good job of being fairly anonymous of moving to different cities. So it was only something that came up recently. I mean, my cousin read the article. She lives here in LA and she called me and she was like, you're blowing our cover, you know, because she was like, what the heck? Why are you, how did that? I'm like, I didn't talk about it. It came up, you know.
Was she pissed?
No, of course not.
Did you feel violated that this was this an LA Times thing? Or what was it?
I feel a little violated only because I was just taken a little back, but I had, since moving here, I mean, I belong to Soho House, and I remember sitting there one night and we're not even like friends, like someone I know that goes to the Soho House was sitting next to me at the bar and mentioned the Wrigleys. And I was like, how do you know that? And he was like, oh, I Googled you. I'm like, what? So I'm sure there's plenty of
people.
Was
this an acquaintance?
Yeah, like not even like a friend, like an acquaintance that I, you know, like a Soho House friend.
Why don't you, for people, including myself, who are not people even less familiar than I am with Soho House, to talk about what that is?
Soho House is a members club that was founded in Europe. And in Europe, there are, in London specifically. And I joined when I was living there. And it's place for people in the arts to hang out in London. There are a massive amount of members-only clubs that are dominated by businessmen in suits, and so the founders wanted to have a place where you were not allowed to wear a suit and you had to be creative and in the arts to hang out there. And so I joined it when I was living in London, and there happens to be a outpost here in West Hollywood.
And so you were at that one, and this guy sitting next to you said something to the effect of, I heard you're a Wrigley.
We were talking about baseball. and he mentioned something about the Cubs.
Good segue.
And, yes, actually. And I was like, how did you know that? And he had Googled it. And I was just, and that was, I mean, that was one of the very first times I got like blanket called out on something. And so I think by the time the article had come out, I was a little bit more prepared for it. But I mean, and you know, like people that know me or the girl that works for me, she and I were talking about it, and she was like, I mean, it doesn't take that much effort to figure it out. Just it had never been something that was important or valued to my identity or to my education. So it was just a non-issue for years. And it's only, and not that it's an issue at all anymore, but it's something that I'm cognizant of.
Right. Where did the name go?
The Wrigley?
Yeah.
My grandfather's name is Wrigley Offield.
Mm.
His mother was the daughter of William Wrigley, the founder of the company.
Okay. So it's your second cousins who are Wrigley's then.
Yes.
Something like that.
Something like that.
Right. Okay. Got it. Nice cover. just to go back though, not to beat the dead horse, but this article, it was an article.
Mm-hmm.
And where was it?
It was in LA Confidential.
Okay.
It said Bubblegum Heiress is what it was.
Bubblegum Heiress. That's not even right.
Not even right. Thank you. That was what my stepmom called. My stepmom goes, well, they could have at least gotten it right. It's wow. Chewing gum.
Well, that says a lot. That says everything you need to know about LA Confidential, I think.
So it was a great article, and I really liked it. And it had a lovely picture of my English bulldog, Gus, in it. And it was lovely. But in, like, it was in one of, like, the pre- whatever, like the subtitle.
Right.
And now it said Bubblegum Heiress.
But it was reported. You had a meeting with these people or with this person.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Got it.
And so it really doesn't even talk about it. It just in, like I said, in the, like there's the title of the article and then there's the article. And in the top thing, it says like, oh, we talked with Bubblegum Heiress.
Right.
And her new gallery.
Right.
Yes. My stepmom was like, they should have at least gotten it right. Chewing gum.
Right.
Yes.
And we should mention, since I don't think it's come up yet, that your gallery is named after...
It's named after my beloved English bulldog,
right.
Sir Gusford, yes.
Right. Who you actually got here and brought over to London.
Yes. He's about to celebrate his 10th birthday in a matter of next month. And I actually got him here in California. He lived in Seattle with me for years, took him to England and then brought him back out to California.
Right.
So he's a traveling companion.
Are you going to throw a party for him in the gallery for his birthday?
Yeah, I will definitely throw him a party. It will not have been the first party he's celebrated, but please. I mean, my people are already like, what are you going to do for Gus's 10th birthday?
Yeah.
It's a thing.
He does have... I mean, I'm not that familiar with bulldogs, so you'll have to tell me. But I mean, he does have he's a very mellow bulldog, right?
Yes. I mean, he's 10, so.
Oh, that's part of it? Was he more?
No, he's always been very mellow, and they're a very mellow breed.
Okay.
But yeah, he is definitely slower than he was 8 years ago when he was two. He, you know, was a little more vivacious.
Right. Well, we haven't talked about being a dealer, I mean, other than sort of circling around it. So how long has Gusford been in existence now?
2 years. February 7th, 2013 is when we opened. So we are a couple weeks from that 2-year mark. And it's been exciting. It's been a whole different world. 2.5 years ago, I was living in London and had a studio and was still making work and doing freelance curating and freelance consulting. And I packed up my studio. I moved to LA and within 6 months had found the space and opened it up with a show by an LA artist, Adam Mars. And I mean, never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined how much time I spent talking about insurance and talking to lawyers and running a business, but I love it, and I'm excited to be doing it and to be 2 years down the line. We just bought a new building. I just bought a new building, so we'll be moving and expanding to a bigger space. And
when's that going to be?
That's a good question. Target summer 2015 to open in the new space. Mm-hmm. We'll see how construction goes. We're pulling permits and...
Are you doing this thing that a lot of, you know, hot galleries are doing these days and hiring these, like, sort of celebrity architects to design their spaces?
I don't know if they're celebrity. I have hired Pre-Doc Frayne Architects. John Frayne is my point architect. They did Hannah Hoffman's space. So I don't know if they're celebrities. I'll let you guys decide.
Maybe I'm overusing that term, but yeah, I guess, yeah. Okay. Well, you have some, a model to refer to and you know, what you're looking for. So that's always good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got it. When you opened, did you have all the artists that you wanted to represent in mind, or was it kind of like, we're going to start here and then we're going to build that as we go?
Anyone that knows me knows that since I was 20, I've been saying, oh, I'm going to open this gallery. And, you know, so, you know, my family or people have known me for a long time have actually sat there and watched this whole process grow. And so then I had a handful of artists that I knew, and especially when I was moving to LA, working up to that, I had an idea and was developing that. And then once I found the space, I remember sitting down with my director and we divided the artists and we sent out these emails to them asking if they'd like to work with us.
And what was the precedent generally with most of them as far as your relationship?
Either just artists that I had been collecting or had a relationship with, like knew them on a personal level. I mean, I've been collecting since I was 18, so I would say that there's a pretty safe chance that if I wanted to work with them in the gallery, I like their work enough that I'd probably already bought some of their work. But I remember sending out these emails and I was so nervous. I was like, it was like asking a boy out on a date. I was like, what if they say no? Like, what if they don't want to work with me?
Well, what was it that made you decide to email as opposed to calling them
out? Because like half of them were over in Europe and, you know, I wanted to give them all the information. So,
right.
You know, in the email it was like, this is the floor plan of the gallery. This is the, you know, the calendar we're trying to put together right now. We're working this out. I mean, the first artist, Adam Mars, was local. I mean, obviously I met with him in person. Any of the artists that were like local, I called up or met with in person, but
sure.
And a handful of them are abroad. So
that makes sense. All right. Yeah.
Timing that out. I was emailing them.
Good point. Sorry.
Yeah. No, sorry.
That makes a lot of sense.
Because I came out of Europe, I would say about half my artists are European based. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, that was where I was based. That was where, you know, I was seeing art every single day and where I was working, coming into it. And then, you know, I've been looking more at American artists as we're here. But when we were starting, you know, I had a strong, you know, I wanted to be diverse, but, you know, at the end of the day, it has to be artists that I connect with.
Did you have any, or do you have any, same question, heroes, dealer-wise, that you had in the back of your mind as you were starting to make this quest for putting together your own stable?
I don't think I have any heroes, dealer-wise. I mean, I have so much admiration for what Sean Regan does, and she's been doing it for 25 years, and she runs that space, and it's amazing. I think that's great. You know, I really want to run a unique space that really works with my artists. So I don't wouldn't say that I had any, like, was sitting there looking at a dealer in particular.
Sure.
As my, you know, glowing model, I think more than anything, I had used my experience of working in various galleries and with various gallerists to figure out more what not to do and to figure out what it was that I did want to do
right
in my own space.
You know, the fact that you've been a collector for a long time is interesting for, if for no other reason than it's been very hard to get collectors to come on this show. Not that I've tried extensively, but the times that I have, it hasn't gone very far. So you get to stand in as well for collectors. But I think more to the point is sort of maybe a good place to start with a question is what it's been like going from being the collector to being the dealer. So you, in other words, to put it the sort of as crassly as possible, I suppose, you're going from the one who is being catered to the one who is catering, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's like walking through a field with landmines. Like you're just, and that's ongoing. It's an ongoing thing that I navigate, you know, because I still collect. So I still, you know, but I mean, it's been even a struggle now. Like when I try to buy pieces now, other dealers are like, oh, is this for your gallery? I'm like, no, this is just for my personal collection. Like I have to be very explicit because now other dealers are like, wonder what I'm going to do with the work that I'm buying of there. And I'm like, no, it's just for my personal collection. But that I've stumbled into that as a problem now.
Yeah.
And you know, as far as navigating my collectors that I deal to, I mean, that's just the same as any, except at the end of the day, I guess I have an understanding as to why, from that perspective, like why I first started collecting the artists that I'm dealing and what I've been looking at for a long time. So it's just another, you know, and I mean, obviously for some of my collectors, it's, you know, obviously I'm standing behind it. I'm putting my money where my mouth is, and I'm also
right
collecting these artists. So
right,
I'm clearly saying that I think that this is a pretty safe bet. But I mean, it's a, you know, navigating treacherous water sometimes.
Does anything particular come to mind when you use that expression?
Oh, no. I mean, not with my collectors. But I mean, it's just like with any relationship. And I mean, more than anything, the biggest thing is on then when I'm buying as a collector, the previous mentioned that I run into problems because other dealers think I have ulterior motives. And I'm like, no, I'm not buying this. It's Kelsey Lee Offield, the owner of Gusford. I'm buying this as Kelsey Lee Offield, you know, admirer of said artist and collecting.
It seems, would it be safe to say, do you think that dealers of late in such a hot market are more frequently able to ask the question, you know, what is your intention in buying
this
work?
Absolutely. Yes. And it's insulting. And
yeah,
it absolutely happens. And
yeah,
yes, it is insulting.
So when you started buying at 18, was that like in Michigan? Was that in Southern California? Was that in Europe? Is that everywhere?
All of the above. Yeah.
And what sort of galleries have you bought from over the years? I mean, the whole spectrum of from, you know,
absolutely
small to large.
Yeah. I would say that, you know, I mean, like when I was younger, it was a very, you can see as you walk around and look at my collection, you know, it runs whole gamut. And I also, you know, hang pieces I've inherited from my family, and my father and my mother, they've are avid collectors of California Impressionist painters. So, you know, I've got like old works, and then I've got them next to contemporary works. And then, I forgot the question.
It was about, I guess in the context of being the collector, you know, and dealing with galleries as a collector, you know, what sort of those, you know, because if you're, say, I don't know, in London, you know, and you're buying something there. I mean, I don't know if you're dealing with, you know, like a white cube gallery, or, you know, you're dealing with sort of an unknown kind of neighborhood gallery, or both.
Both.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously when you're dealing with those bigger galleries, you really have to be assertive, I would assume, to sort of, you know, get what you want, get treated like you want to be treated, and that kind of thing.
I mean, that's, I, you, yes. I mean, you know, that's just collecting, and that's getting what, that's just buying. And I mean, I haven't had too many problems with that. Usually it's at the initial stage when I send out an email and my signature on my email mentions Gusford Gallery or something.
Mm.
And, you know, or the first time, or if I have to hand over my business card, whatever it is, it's usually in the beginning that I get denied. And then once we work through,
mm-hmm.
This is just for me and my collecting.
Right.
It's usually not a problem. And then I can get my pieces.
So you mentioned how much time you've been spending with the business, the lawyer, you know, the contracts and what have you. I know that you've done at least one fair in Miami that you did recently. How are you doing? Since you've been open, how many fairs have you been doing?
So we've done Pulse in New York during Freeze Week in March last year. And we did Pulse, I think it was in March. And then we did Pulse in Miami. And we'll keep looking at doing those fairs and growing and maturing up to, you know, the more major players in the fairs. That's a whole different world. Going to fairs as a collector is so enjoyable. Going to fairs as a dealer is so not enjoyable. So.
I think we're going to have to use... for our gallery that goes along with this podcast, because the good news for you about the fair that you did in Miami is that I think ArtF City, you know, gave you a big plug, and so at some point it led me to this picture of you and your director, I presume, staring down at your phones, hovering in the corners of your booth. Right?
Yep.
That's it. Says a lot, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We were doing a solo exhibition of a Singaporean artist named Genevieve Chua. And the first day, our little chairs were like in the center of the booth. And you could really see that like people were intimidated to walk into the booth. So we had pushed them into the corner. And that's the photo you're referring to. And yeah, I'm probably sending emails out because I have the humongous iPhone 6 Plus. So I can do all of my work from that. And Michelle is looking at her computer, and yeah, Patty said it was her favorite installation. And then she came in, but I mean, you know, like you can just see it. Like people are intimidated to come enter a booth, and you know, it was Miami and we weren't carrying the most lighthearted art in the world. So I think we were just trying to make the space more inviting. Yeah.
Right. Got it. Is there anything that you feel like we haven't covered?
No, I think we've covered quite, you know, big portion of it.
Big portion? What's the portion that we haven't covered?
Oh, no, I think we've covered it.
Okay. I know. I knew you didn't have anything hiding behind that. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And we're out. There you go. Thank you very much again to Kelsey Leofield for sitting down with me, for hosting me. I hope you enjoyed that. Do let us know what your thoughts are about the episode. Comments, feedback, always welcome at theconversationpod.com and the various social media outlets. I will remind you that you are welcome to support the show in a number of ways. Support is very much appreciated financially through the website, or certainly you can support the show by becoming a fan on the various social media outlets. I wanted to thank some people who donated after the 100th episode, a couple episodes ago. You are still welcome to join in that celebration as well. Thank you very much to Guan of New York. Sorry, I'm not pronouncing your Chinese name correctly. that well, but you know who you are. I want to thank Judy Tavil of Judy Tavil Ceramics, Sydney Croskery of Los Angeles, an artist in Los Angeles, and I want to thank Jeff Morris in Oakland, if I remember right, who not only donated after the 100th episode, but also donated during the Kickstarter, which was almost 2 years old now. So thank you to all you guys. And if you'd like to join them, it would be very much appreciated. And you can also, if you haven't already, subscribe on iTunes. And if you don't even use iTunes, that's okay. You can subscribe to the Conversation Unartist podcast on iTunes and then even unsubscribe right away. And apparently I've heard from another podcaster that that helps your analytics. And we need analytics help to get the word out, help more people find the show. TheConversationPod.com. Again, let us know what you think of this episode, any other episode, and become a fan on social media, et cetera, et cetera. Appreciate your being here, especially you regulars. You guys are the best. I will talk to you soon, if not this coming Saturday, the one after that. Thank you very much, and good night, good luck, and onward and upward with the arts.